Well, good morning. I really enjoyed Stephanie's presentation. Was sitting there thinking we're going to use the videotape of that in our evaluation courses at Michigan State. You also might have seen me chuckling a few times because in many of those challenges that were described, it felt like I was describing kind of my life. And at one point, I looked at my NIJ monitor for a current project that involves the evaluation of comprehensive anti-gang initiative across the U.S. when Stephanie made the comment about the importance of having timely evaluations. And kind of the reality of the world when you're looking at multiple sites is we have 10 sites that are implementing 3 different program components all at different times and different places and creating real challenges. So I had just recently had asked, Lewis, we need another extension on this evaluation. So I don't know how timely we'll be. We also have a natural experiment this morning. I noticed that Stephanie had 9 PowerPoint slides. Following the dictates of good PowerPoint presentations, I will violate that principle. I have a ton of slides. We'll be moving quickly and maybe an inch deep on a lot of these topics. But hopefully, and I think that the two presentations complement each other quite well. I think there's plenty of evidence that we haven't always used evidence, the goal of evidence-based practice to guide our research. And many of you are familiar with the University of Maryland study about 13 years ago and reviewed a large number of evaluations in criminal justice research and different types of research. And they concluded only about 13% of those studies kind of met the standard of methodological rigor. David Weisbord has a very recent article in Criminology and Public Policy, again, reviewed a large number of policing evaluations, specifically looking at problem solving. And you can see, now David's pretty strict on his standards of what meets methodological rigor, but if only 10 out of 5,500 are meeting that standard, we've got a ways to go. And what you typically see, and this is, I think Stephanie described this, is the kind of usual work involves looking at a single site, doing a simple pre and post assessment with no comparisons. And that does open us up to all these variety of rival explanations. If you do, for the baseball fans out there that have followed the All-Star game over about the last 40 years, if you do a simple correlation of the tendency of the National League to win those games versus the tendency of the American League, you will find a strong correlation with violent crime trends in the United States. As the American League has come to reassert dominance, violent crime has dropped dramatically. Now, I don't believe that that's the likely cause of that decline, but that's the problem with those kinds of evaluations. On the other hand, I think there is, as Phelan said in his introductory comments, there's a lot of evidence that we are entering an era where there is a serious commitment towards building this kind of evidence-based practice. And you hear that in the leadership of OJP and Lori Robinson, Mary Lou Leary, and others who've been pushing this for quite some time. You also see it within the field of criminology and a lot of different indicators. Essentially, what we're trying to do is to build this evidence-based practice, and I would argue through 3 kind of ways. One is to, as Stephanie laid out very nicely, is to build stronger research designs and to move from these kind of simple designs to controlled comparisons, quasi-experiments, and experiments. Also, to accumulating evidence through a number of studies and building that body of evidence through systematic reviews and meta-analyses and similar approaches. And thirdly, I think doing more to try to connect theory to our evaluation. If we can identify the theoretical components behind why we think an intervention should have an effect, if we see an effect or we don't see an effect, but we can link that back to should the intervention have had an effect according to this theory, then we will have stronger conclusions as we look at that evidence. So what I want to do is to draw on about 15 years of evidence in these three areas. I do this at the risk of being very egocentric in that these are areas that I've been working in. But I think this is kind of a glass half full, glass half empty presentation. You know, you look at the Maryland study and Weisberg's study, and you might feel a little bit pessimistic in our ability to put together this evidence-based. But on the other, from another perspective, if you compare where we are today in 2010 to where we were in the early to mid 1990s, I think we've come a significant way in building evidence. And I use these as examples. Other researchers could look at correctional research or some drug intervention research and make similar kind of comments. But these just happen to be the areas that I think I know a little bit about. So let's talk about addressing gun violence. In the early 1990s, I was working in Spokane, Washington, with their police department, with the chiefs and sheriffs of the state of Washington, and doing a lot of kind of interesting, what I thought was interesting work in community policing and problem solving. And we were seeing some impact in terms of addressing neighborhood-level disorder and the relationship between police and citizens. But I remember being asked by the chief of Spokane, what do we do about this violence problem? About that time, I moved back to the state of Indiana, and I began working in partnership with the Indianapolis Police Department. And the mayor at that time was a former prosecutor, and Indianapolis was experiencing big increases in homicide and gun violence. And I remember meeting with him saying, you know, what does the research say in terms of effective interventions to deal with gun violence and homicide? And I sat there in silence. There wasn't anything I could point to. And I think that was a pretty fair reading of the evidence at the time. Since that time, there's been, again, a lot of evidence emerging that there are things that we can do. And so I want to work through this development of this knowledge base, because I think it builds on Stephanie's points in terms of how we've moved from weak designs, but pointing us in a suggestive way towards promising interventions to continually building stronger designs. And I guess that would be the theme that I would hope to leave us with today. So in about this time that the mayor of Indianapolis was posing this question, I was trying to remember this morning. It was either an NIJ conference or it was an ASC conference, and Larry Sherman did a presentation, hadn't been published yet, on research he was doing in Kansas City, in which they had done a quasi-experiment. What they looked at was if we could use directed police patrol at gun crime hotspots and tell those police officers to focus on illegally possessed firearms, could we have an impact on gun crime? And basically the findings that came out of that is the seizures of illegally possessed firearms increased by 70%, those areas experienced a 49% decrease in firearms crimes. So pretty promising evidence here. But again, a single site, one point in time. Indianapolis decided to take see if they could implement a similar kind of approach. They had two target areas and two comparison areas. The target areas you'll see labeled as the North and East districts. They were slightly different strategies. Pretty significant drop in violent gun violence in that North area, a decline in the East area as well. And they had the comparison. So in a quasi-experimental kind of approach, had a comparison area that actually had witnessed an increase. And then we also looked at what was happening at the city as a whole. And so the data seemed to suggest that in these two targeted areas, using the strategy of directed police patrol, looking for illegally possessed guns, that you could have an impact consistent with Kansas City. We did time series analysis, which ruled out some rival hypotheses, but basically came away with this conclusion that when you focused on these gun crime hotspots and those illegally possessed firearms, it appeared that you could have a significant impact. Then there was a third study in this series that came out of Pittsburgh. Very similar kind of approach. They added one additional piece to this research in that they In addition to using police statistics, they also went to the trauma center and looked at gunshot injuries. And those gunshot injuries declined very consistently with the police data. And so again, suggesting that this kind of approach was having an impact. When the Pittsburgh findings were presented, Sherman wrote a commentary on that, and he brought several additional studies. So at that point, you ended up with 8 tests of this intervention, all of which indicated a decline in gun crime, and suggesting, you know, well, you could question any one of these studies, but when you looked kind of collectively, it did suggest a promising approach to addressing gun crime. About the same time, in mid-1990s, many of you are probably familiar with the Boston Gun Project, Boston Ceasefire, used what some have referred to as a pulling levers approach to trying to address youth homicide. One of the things that I think is interesting about the Boston study is it kind of followed this progression of trying to increasingly build the rigor of these evaluations. So the first study that came out of this was a simple pre-post comparison, and after implementing this intervention, they had a 65% reduction in youth homicide, pretty impressive. They later tried to strengthen that evidence by comparing what had happened in Boston to a large sample of other cities. Boston was the only place that had experienced this kind of decline. So again, adding to that evidence base. Indianapolis became one of the first places to try to replicate that. I put replication in quotation marks. The natural scientists in the room would probably throw something at me and say, that's not really a replication, because it's almost impossible in criminological research, where the context is always somewhat different, to have a true replication. But a very similar kind of approach, very similar kind of findings. And our comparison, because this was a citywide kind of intervention, was to look at what happened in other similar Midwestern cities, and Indianapolis was the only one to experience that kind of decline, very similar to the Boston findings. Los Angeles saw a similar reduction, or somewhat more modest reduction, but they did note, and again, consistent with what Stephanie was saying, look at how the program was implemented as well. But all three studies coming along and suggesting that this might have an impact. About the same time, a few years later, some of you may be familiar with Project Exile in Richmond. Here the U.S. attorney said, I don't know how to address these problems of serious homicide and gun violence, but the one thing I can do as a U.S. attorney is to prosecute people who are illegally possessing and using firearms to try to incapacitate the highest risk individuals who are shooting people on the streets, and then try to deter others from illegally carrying those guns, primarily focused on felons in possession of a firearm. The first evidence that came out of Richmond was, again, this kind of simple pre-post comparison where homicides went down after this was implemented. The first more formal evaluation that raised some questions because it appeared that, well, the homicide's going down nationally at this time. So how do we know that Richmond isn't just following the national pattern? Rick Rosenfeld later did a further evaluation looking at 2 years follow-up and did this with the comparison of all other U.S. cities and found that, well, indeed, when you look at this, it appears that the decline in Richmond may have been due to this. So you move from, if you take my word, that in 1993-94 we had very little evidence, by about 2000 there were these series of studies that had come out that at least pointed to some promising approaches to addressing homicide and gun violence. That provided the foundation for Project Safe Neighborhoods, major Department of Justice initiative, in which every U.S. attorney's office was to create a PSN task force and to do something kind of building on these Boston ceasefire. The Indianapolis is part of something called Strategic Approaches to Community Safety, or SACSE, and Project Exile. The there wasn't one single model that was followed or urged for adoption, but the model of the program was to use research and analysis to understand the local gun crime problem so that you could then focus on those contexts that seem to be driving gun crime, and then putting limited local and federal enforcement and prosecution resources to focus specifically on those local hotspots. If there was a theoretical model, I guess I would argue it was to try to increase the credibility of a deterrent threat for illegal use of a gun in crime. Now, the PSN evaluation has all the problems Stephanie talked about. It's a national program, so what do you compare it to? We started off, I think, consistent with what Stephanie would have recommended, is that we'll do some case studies. And so look at some of the places that have implemented the program. And it appeared that two different models, one kind of based on that Richmond approach, and then the other that followed more like the Boston ceasefire approach. In all 10 of these sites, we saw a decline in gun crime. In two of the 10, there were questions that you could raise in terms of the evaluation of that. But the evidence, you know, was suggestive. One of the interesting things is, unlike a lot of prior research, the most rigorous design also produced in Chicago some of the strongest evidence. So you couldn't generalize from these case studies about PSN across the whole country, but at least it was suggestive that you might be having an impact on gun crime. So the next step in this was to try to distinguish by levels of dosage. So the comparison becomes low dosage, non-target cities with high dosage, target cities and high dosage locales. Again, I realize I'm moving through this pretty quickly, but happy to talk. Actually, there's a presentation on Wednesday where we'll talk about this again. But to get to the kind of the bottom line here, one of the ways of thinking about the dosage was to look at the level of federal prosecution. And so in the cities that experienced high levels of federal prosecution of gun crime, you saw a very significant decline in violent crime. Percentage-wise, it looks like this. And our kind of contrast was between these target cities and high dosage sites had a 13% reduction. In the low dosage, non-target cities and low dosage, where in effect I would argue PSN really never occurred, you had an 8% increase in violent crime. All this was presented last year's NIJ conference, so let me tell you something new. We've recently published controlling for a lot of the other factors that we think affect city levels of violent crime and find that these patterns are consistent. And perhaps most important is when we now have some firearm homicide data, and the patterns are very similar to what you saw in violent crime. And so, again, the target cities in a high dosage environment, about a 10% decline in gun homicides, compared to these low-dosage sites or these non-target cities that actually experience an 11 or 14% increase. That 25% gap, I think, is pretty telling or suggestive of that this approach can have an impact. Now, there are a whole variety of limitations I won't go into because that's not nearly as much fun to talk about. But all the things Stephanie talked about, you could raise questions about this national evaluation. Chicago ceasefire, another kind of a promising approach, a public health approach where they use street workers to try to intervene in violent crime contexts. A number of you may have heard about this. Wes Scogin and his colleagues have recently published an evaluation of the Chicago ceasefire. It's complicated because during this period, Chicago is experiencing a decline in violent crime. So teasing out whether it's ceasefire or something else is difficult. But what they concluded, they looked at 7 hotspot areas. They saw declines in 6 of those where ceasefire was occurring. The violent crime was down in 6 of those areas, and it appeared that at least in 4 of those 6 areas that ceasefire may have been associated with that decline. To complicate the picture, we've recently completed an assessment of a similar program that was based on the Chicago model in Pittsburgh. The people that ran the what's called One Vision, One Life in Pittsburgh were actually trained in the Chicago model. We had three target areas, which are compared to both matched comparisons as well as statistically constructed comparisons. And not only did we not see any impact, but actually saw an increase in aggravated assaults and in gun assaults, leaving us somewhat perplexed on what this all means. It may be something about whether the Pittsburgh program was implemented with a degree of fidelity to the logic model and the appropriate levels of dosage. It may be something that has to do with the different gang structure in the two cities. Maybe the Chicago results were due to that overall violence, or maybe it's something else. But I use this example because I think it again reinforces a point Stephanie made of the need to move from one place and one point in time to looking at multiple interventions and try to. I think the next few years we'll be trying to sort this out in terms of what do these Pittsburgh findings mean. So now, 15 years, you know, going from nothing, I was trying to think about doing some kind of pre and post slide here, where if you asked me in 1994, everything would have been blank. But now I think we can point to a number of at least promising, if not evidence-based practices to inform how do we respond to gun crime. I'm going to make Phelan really nervous here because I got 1 minute to go through the rest of my slides. But let me just, so the point here would be, I think clearly we've made a number of advances in these efforts. I want to point, go real quickly, could handle this in questions, but that Boston model has been applied to deal with drug markets. At this point, kind of a simple pre and post evaluation has been done. There are a number of sites that are now using this kind of drug market intervention approach. There's some data that comes out of Rockford and Nashville that we've done that suggests, yeah, maybe this model is having an impact. But the point I wanted to make is I think this is really how we hope this evidence-based model will move forward, and that the High Point gave us this promising evidence. A number of other sites have implemented this and seem to be having an impact. And now we see NIJ and BJA working together. There's an RFP that may have just closed, or it's about to close. It is closed, okay. To do a very rigorous evaluation. So BJA is going to provide training to a group of sites in this model who will participate in this evaluation, and then using the most rigorous evaluation techniques, will apply them. And so we'll move. I think at the end of this process, we will know, you know, does this promising evidence hold out when you move to a more rigorous point? So let me just conclude. I'll skip over the restorative justice stuff. I knew I wouldn't get that in. But I think there's several points that I would hope to leave you with. One is to think about this as a building block kind of model. Oftentimes moving from kind of grounded experience, police researcher or practitioner researcher collaborations that look at promising practices, moving towards quasi experiments, and then where possible moving to the randomized controlled experiment. I don't think it is an either or choice, but we need to think about the strongest design that's feasible given where we are in the state of knowledge at the time, given resource constraints and the nature of the intervention. I'd argue, again, linking theory to practice. And to conclude, I think one of the important points for those criminal justice executives and policymakers in the audience, I think one of the things that can really benefit the field is for you to insist on high-quality evaluations. Anthony Braga has a commentary on Weisbert in the same issue that Weisbert's article is in, and he talks about his experience of working with Chief Ed Davis, first in Lowell, now in Boston. This is my experience in Indianapolis. When the chief, when the mayor, when the juvenile court judge, when a prosecutor say, I'll try this, but I want to know whether it really has an impact, that puts us in a position to do these kind of challenging but very important evaluations that can give us that evidence base. Thank you. Mm-hmm.